We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Bite.
Welcome to the Forever a Bull podcast, connecting with the UB stars of the past. Here's your host, voice of the Bulls, Paul Peck.
And we have a legitimate star UB alum on this edition of the Forever a Bull podcast. And anybody that's been around UB football or been to a game or been in the Gusevich Club in the last couple of years, the inimitable presence of Jim Mouse McNally is always there. One of the more notable and famous UB football and coaching alums joining us from his home in Western New York on our Forever a Bull podcast. Mouse, for anybody that follows you on Facebook knows that the one thing you have been doing is keeping in shape. Credit to you for all the workout videos.
Well, I do it for fun. You know, I've been doing my chin-ups, and recently every day I put a little different outfit on. I put a different hat on or a different shirt on, and I give some shout-outs to something weird. You know, yesterday I had a hat from a small town in Idaho, McCall, and then I had a shirt from 1989, Montana Grizzlies. So, yeah, I do some crazy stuff. All for fun, though.
You are as much a bundle of energy as anybody that I have ever met in my career here, so I don't know how you, of all people, are holding up on all this as we're all struggling our way through to stay busy. You know, you're a perpetually in motion. How have you handled all this?
Well, to be honest with you, the corona thing is very serious. We know that. But I have other issues that are, you know, I don't have cancer or anything life-threatening, but I have other little issues physically that bother me. So I'm always worried about, oh, this hurts or that hurts, or I got to get this CAT scan or I got to go there. So kind of other little things, and I've been doing some projects for the Bengals. So the corona thing isn't the number one thing on my mind. Obviously, it would be if I caught it, but right now, other things occupy me.
Right. Well, before we get into what we want to talk about is your UB career, you mentioned that even though you're retired, you've been working with the Bengals, where you've certainly had a long association, and you know, the draft obviously still going on. So what exactly have you been doing for the Bengals? What kind of contributions are you helping the football program out with?
Well, during the season, I do projects on the opponents. You know, all the defensive linemen, the linebackers, all the moves they have. Like you could watch a defensive player and you can see his multiple moves, the same move over and over again. And, you know, on the running game or the passing game. And then during the draft and free agency, I did a lot of college players, a lot of NFL players. And right now I'm doing I'm sending the coaches some drills that I do with videos of, you know, offensive linemen doing these particular techniques. So I deal with closely with the video people because I only have an iPad and I don't edit. So I have all the videos and I have all the drills and all this, that, and the other, but I have to tell the video people, send this, send that, because I don't edit. But anyway, so, but I have an iPad and there's a lot on it.
I bet there is. Okay, so all of this starts for you in the mid-60s as a graduate of Kenmore West High School in Western New York. And I don't know that I knew this necessarily until the great feature story they did on you in The Athletic a week or so ago, but I didn't realize you were a walk-on at UB. So what went into the process? Yeah, what went into the process of deciding on UB and figuring out a way to get that walk-on position, you know, then under Coach Offenhammer?
Well, there were a few other people from my high school, Kenmore, and then it turned into Kenmore West, Jerry Gergely and Larry Gergely. Jerry was about 4 years older than me, and Larry was 1 year, and we were from Kenmore. And so they were familiar with our football team. You know, obviously I was undersized. I was probably 5'9", if you stretch me. I might have weighed 200 pounds. And they recruited me. I think a fellow's name was Mike Rhodes, a defensive line coach, had the local area. And I went up there for a visit, you know, on a weekend. And they wanted me to come as a walk-on. I made all Western New York. But my grades weren't very good. So I really couldn't get into regular UB. So I had to go to what they call university college, which was like going to night school, but you could go during the day. And I got accepted and I was able to play freshman football, but I had to get good grades to be a regular student in the four-year program, which I was able to do after that first semester of my freshman year. And then about the end of my sophomore year, Buddy Ryan was our coach, and we went into this dark room and tried to kill each other, you know, going one-on-one and putting a new defense in. And I ended up lettering as a sophomore and starting as a junior and a senior, and I earned a scholarship, and that's it. But if it wasn't for Buddy Ryan being my coach and kind of molded me a little bit, I don't know if I've ever played. And another guy named Joe Shiflett was a graduate assistant coach, and he was one of my coaches. And he told Coach Offenhammer and Coach Ryan, he said, they had me as a linebacker. Well, I couldn't see. And they said, you got to put him down as a down guy, even though I was short. And they did, and that's where I kind of flourished.
Yeah, Joe Shiflett went on to a very long, distinguished career coaching here in Western New York as well, too. You mentioned it, 5'9", 200. Now, I get it. In the 60s, the sizes were different, certainly not what they are now. But even, like you said, that was small. How is it that you were successful as a lineman when even then you were undersized?
Yeah, I think the most I ever weighed at UB was 210, you know, as I graduated. I don't know. You know, we played both ways, and we played both ways till my senior year. Then I just played offense. But my sophomore and junior year, we would play both ways. And there were two teams that played the whole game. I mean, for example, now offense plays and defense plays. Then you played offense and defense. And after a couple of series, the next group came in. So there wasn't really a first string or a second string. There were two groups of players that played, but you played both ways. I don't know. I mean, people would say I had pretty good technique. I was pretty quick. On defense, I played over the guard, and I was kind of flexed. I was kind of like a linebacker. I wasn't a linebacker, but they played me off the ball, you know, in a stance, in a four-point stance, actually, where I could read the center and step here, and I kind of would run around people. And, you know, it was kind of a finesse thing to avoid blockers, I guess almost maybe like the radar defense. And I made a lot of tackles. And but the guy next to me, we played a wide tackle six, which means there were two guys over the guards and nobody right up the middle. I mean, there was I was over the one guard and my buddy was over the other guard. And there was a big hole up the middle. And I was short, so my assignment on the passing game was to watch the draws of the screens. The other guy was rushing. Now, we, you know, the defensive ends would rush and so forth. So I had the draws in the screens, and I think I had decent technique, and the keys that I used enabled me to make a lot of tackles.
All right, so 1962 to 64 is when you play, when UB was one of the powers in Eastern college football, and you're only all that, you know, only a few years removed from that 1958 team that I think most Bulls fans know the story behind, that was one of the preeminent teams in the East. So what was it like to play at UB? What was the level of play? What was it like playing for Coach Offenhammer at the time, who was also the coach in 1958?
Well, you know, we didn't know much about, or I didn't know much, Division I, Division II, Division III. I mean, I think we were in the Lambert Cup area, which is, I think we were considered small college. And, you know, we played good teams, but then some teams you would say, I mean, we would play a team like Gettysburg or Bucknell or a few other teams that you would say what might be Division III now or Division II. My printer is popping out here. But but then we would play Boston College. We played Villanova. We played Holy Cross. We played Boston U. At that time, some of those teams were playing D1 football. They played Syracuse and some other bigger teams.
What was Coach Offenhammer like?
He was a kind of a tough guy. I mean, he was a good guy. He was a military guy. He was a boxer actually in the army, and he went to Colgate. And he played. He was a running back, I believe. But he was kind of a tough guy. I mean, he wasn't nasty or anything like that. But just kind of, you know, you kind of respected him. He was kind of hard nosed. And he was good, you know. With me, though, I had a more relationship with my individual coach, you know, Buddy Ryan and the line coach, you know, Coach LaRocque, the assistant coaches, Coach Deming. You know, the head coach was kind of the head coach, you know what I mean? You dealt more with the assistants.
Well, so that leads me to the question about Buddy Ryan. Obviously, we've all come to know, at least football fans that, you know, can remember the 80s and 90s to kind of have our own image and idea what Buddy Ryan was like. How much different or the same was Buddy when you were playing for him in the 60s at UB to the Buddy Ryan that became certainly one of the most prominent assistant coaches in NFL history and quite the hard ass, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, well, obviously, I knew him under both circumstances, when I played for him, and then when I coached in the NFL, we would play against his teams, and I'd meet him on the sideline. But, I mean, it was when I was a player, it was more player-coach relationship. And then I was older as a coach, and he was the same. I mean, he wasn't coaching me at that time, but we would talk casually, and how you doing, and, you know, we were friends. It wasn't, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to visit with him, you know, before the game. Hey, coach, how you doing? Hey, good luck, blah, blah, blah. As I did when I played for him, when you were with him 2 or 3 hours a day. So it was a different relationship.
So
does that screw up our podcast?
No, we're good. We're good. Your wife's got work to do. That's certainly fine. So, all right. So 1965, after you graduate, you become a student coach at UB, and then that leads to a grad assistant. Yes. So you're kind of working under Buddy Ryan. And then there was a coaching change too. Doc Urich.
One year under Buddy Ryan.
Okay.
1 year. And then Dick Offenhammer resigned and right. Buddy Ryan left. And gotcha. Then Doc Urich.
So obviously, is it safe to say that's where the coaching bug came for you? Is that you know, you talked about you as a player, you were a technician anyway, but was it an easy transition into coaching? Is that when you kind of decided that this is what you might want to pursue as a career?
Well, in the season of 65, I was a fifth-year student. It took me 5 years to graduate, so they gave me a scholarship to be a coach, but I wasn't a graduate student yet. I was still an undergraduate student. So that's when I worked with Buddy Ryan with the defensive line, okay? So then I graduated, okay, and then the new coach came in, Doc Urich. So I had already had 1 year of coaching with Buddy Ryan and Dick Offenhammer. And then when the new coach came in, Doc Urich, they hired me as a GA, a legitimate graduate assistant, because then I went to graduate school for 2 years. So I did have the 1 year as a student assistant, and then I went 2 years as a graduate assistant, still the same thing, you're a student coach. And then after 3 years of a student type of a coach, they hired me as the freshman football coach under Doc Urich.
So what was it like coaching then? What appealed to you most? What did you enjoy most about making that transition to being a coach?
Well, my degree was in business administration, and I wanted no part of that, even though my dad said, because I told my dad coming out of high school, I think I want to be a phys ed teacher. He says, you don't want to be a gym teacher. All they do is roll the balls out. So my dad talked me into taking business, which I did it. But being a coach being a player in sports in high school and at UB, I really didn't want to go into business or sales. And it just happened when Buddy Ryan asked me to come out, and football was my life, basically. That kind of transitioned me into, hey, this is really what I want to do.
Who were some of the memorable players and that you played with, got to know, coached? I mean, who were some of those guys that you still have fond memories of? And I know some of them you still have relationships with.
Well, actually, when I was playing at UB, 1 year ahead of me was Jerry Philbin, who's one of the all-time greats, played with the Jets, played the Super Bowl. He was a defensive end, a great player for us. We had a great quarterback named John Stofa. And then the next year, I'm still playing now, Don Gilbert, one of the greatest athletes to come out of Western New York. I think he played starting quarterback at Bennett High School at age 14. Don Gilbert's a local guy, and Jerry Philbin, and we had a lot of other real good players. Edgar Poles played in Canada, was a terrific player. Kevin Brinkworth was a real tough guy, who's a local guy. And then, still is, no question about that. And then when I started to coach, we had, oh my God, we had some good players. We had Leland Jones, who led the nation, I believe, in scoring. He was a fullback, but he carried the ball all the time. We had Denny Mason, that was a great high school coach, John Fowler. We had a number of Danny Walgate, who worked up at UB for years. He was a defensive lineman. We had a lot of great coaches that worked after that. Sam Sanders, a guy named Rick Lance. Terry Ransbury, a local guy that was a terrific high school coach locally. He was a coach at UB. We had a guy named Teddy Gibbons, a defensive lineman that was terrific. He was out of Rhode Island. We had a number of guys, that it's too hard to mention all of them. But I'd say the biggest names that I played with would be Jerry Philbin, John Stofa, Don Gilbert, that were kind of my years.
Those are good
Rich
names.
Condino was a coach. Absolutely.
Yeah, those are good names that a lot of Bulls fans will certainly recognize. All right, so you're there at UB the football program gets dropped. And I don't know a whole lot about this, and I'm not sure that a lot of Bulls fans know about it. What was it like when that happened? Why did it happen? What was the attitude, the mood there? And obviously that sent you off into other opportunities I'll talk about in a moment. But what was that like when the decision was made to end the program?
I believe it was the season of 70. Yeah, in the season of 69, we had a good year. Doc Urich left, I believe, in 68. And in 69, we had a good year. I think we were like 8-4. I think we beat Boston College, beat Villanova, and then all of a sudden that revolt on campus, the Vietnam War, the student revolt, we had an issue with student fees. I think we had like 20-some thousand students at the time, I'm not sure. And there was a $25 student fee deal, and the students declined to pay the $25 student fee. Now, I don't know whether that covers sports or all fees, but we didn't have that income coming in. And the state of New York, Albany, or whatever, whoever ran that show, did not support sports or the athletic program that following year. So we dropped football. We didn't have any money. And we were flying around the country playing teams like Iowa State and North Carolina State, which you got to get on an airplane, you got to stay in a hotel, you know, stuff like that. So I know we played Holy Cross, one of our last games, and we had a student revolt parade walking around the track during the football game. Okay, I don't know if it was during the game or at halftime. So here I'm up in the – I remember I was up in the press box at that time for whatever reason that year, and I was looking down, and here's all these students walking around the track, their flags and bandanas, protesting, you know, whatever. So that was our downfall.
So it wasn't because of the program was successful. It was those reasons, not football reasons.
Absolutely. It was funds. You know, we were not in a league. We didn't have any support from New York. Obviously, we probably didn't have a lot of, you know, alumni funds coming in. And progressively, we went from playing teams like Bucknell, Gettysburg, whatever, to Iowa State, to Boston College, to North Carolina State. So Villanova was good at that time. And then we were kind of, because some of those bigger teams were putting us on the schedule, you know, to fill up their schedule. And then obviously we dropped football, and in 70, it was like 7 or 8 years without football. So you lost all of those football player, alumni, support group, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, no question about that. So that sends you off on your incredible journey of coaching in college and then ultimately the NFL. And I did want to ask you about your first college job. I believe it was your first college job, because that you make the move to Marshall, which is coming right after the very tragic plane crash that sends the Marshall program in turmoil. And anybody that's seen the movie We Are Marshall knows there's a Jim McNally character in it as well. What was that like, being a part of the resurrection of that program? And you're still a very young man and a young coach.
Yeah, it was November 14th, 1970. Marshall was playing East Carolina in Greenville, North Carolina. And they flew to play East Carolina. And then after the game, they flew home. And the ironic thing was there were three or four coaches that had driven cars because they were scouting high school games the night before en route from Huntington, West Virginia to Greenville, North Carolina. So some of the coaches were not on the plane when the plane crashed after, you know, they returned from East Carolina. UB had dropped football, and I was at the convention in Houston, and we were looking for jobs. And it just happened that I knew a guy named Mike Stock, who was one of our assistant coaches at UB under Doc Urich, who was a good friend of the new head coach at Marshall, Jack Lengel. He got me an interview. I was hired at Marshall. And but again, I was looking for a job. They did not fire us at UB. The six or seven assistant coaches that were still there, they gave us miscellaneous jobs. Like my job was coaching aerobics to anybody over 70 years old, I think, and opening and closing Clark Gym. Well, sooner or later, you know, I had to get a job, or they had to put you somewhere. And like Bill Dando stayed in the alumni or in the athletic department. Terry Ransbury stayed, and a number of us went on to other jobs. But again, I had to get a job, and I knew a guy that knew a guy, and Marshall needed a coach and needed assistant coaches, because all of the coaches but three were killed in the plane crash. So that's how I got to Huntington, West Virginia.
And that gets you started on the incredible run of, like I said, colleges and then to the NFL, certainly the Bengals, most prominently Carolina, the Giants in Buffalo with the Bills. As you reflect back on that college and NFL career, you know, how much of what you learned at Buffalo was part of it? How much did that form the foundation for what you would eventually become as what most people consider one of the all-time great offensive line coaches in NFL history?
Well, I think it was just maybe the work habits that I developed, maybe the discipline under a guy like Coach Ryan, maybe the work habits that I studied under a fellow that was Doc Urich's line coach. His name was Bob Geiger. I've mentioned him before. And he was the offensive line coach under Doc Urich, and he was meticulous and great work habits. And, man, I said, this guy's a workaholic. And so I kind of modeled myself, or I tried to kind of copy him. And I think just those work habits that not necessarily the techniques that I learned or the drills, because obviously you grew and you adopted new techniques and new drills through the years. But I think it was just the work habits, you know, maybe it had something to do with my dad. My dad said, you're never going to quit anything. I mean, he wasn't going to punch me in the nose, but I mean, he was always there for me. And he's in the Canisius College Hall of Fame. He was played football, basketball, and baseball. So, I mean, as growing up, I mean, he was always had my back and always, you know, helping me to move on. And so anything, I think my father, Buddy Ryan, and then this Bob Geiger, and then having to go to Marshall where you had to work your butt off recruiting and selling the program, and we don't have a team, and just the whole thing, you know what I mean? And then what happened was, luckily, after Marshall, I went to Boston College, and I had 8 or 9 or 10 NFL linemen there. They weren't all pros, but all of a sudden, I was able to jump and coach some terrific players. You know, when I was at Wake Forest, I had 3 or 4 that are in the NFL. Billy Ard played guard for the Giants for a number of years.
Yeah,
a guy named Richard
Bowl,
Ball.
Super Bowl team, sure.
Super Bowl teams. But, you know, Wake Forest, Boston College, and then, you know, I went to the Bengals and whatever. But, again, I had some good players in college, and I think it was just the wanting to learn, wanting to be the best that I may have all started at UB.
I grew up a big Giants fan in New Jersey. I remember Billy Ard was a huge Giants fan. He was from New Jersey, and I always remember his family before the draft wanted the Giants to draft him, and they either put up a poster or a banner or something that said, "Let Ard be your guard."
Absolutely.
And he was a really good player on their Super Bowl teams. So football comes back at UB as you're making your way through the NFL. How much do you try to keep in touch with the program? How much do you stay connected with this, you know, at the time Division III and working its way back to where UB is now?
Well, I always stayed in touch, and I always would visit a little here and there when I was away. But when I came back to the Bills in 2004, I think Jim Hoffer was still the coach then.
Correct.
And Jim Hoffer was one of our graduate assistants at Wake Forest. And I may have or may not have helped him get the UB job. He earned it himself, but I mean, maybe I gave him a recommendation there. So I knew Jim Hoffer real well. We were good friends. So coming back to the Bills, the UB, Jim Hoffer, the coach, you know, I would go to practice when I could and go to some of the games. And then after I retired in 2008, then with Coach Quinn, who I recommended for the job because I knew him well from Cincinnati because he was a coach at the University of Cincinnati. And then I was able to go on the trips more, be more involved, go to practice more, and they treat me great there. So
reflect for me a little bit on what you've seen this program become since it's come back to Division I in 99. And as you mentioned, 2008, you get involved with Coach Quinn and now where things are at with Coach Leipold. Just reflect a little bit on what you've seen the growth. And again, you and your teammates have played a part in that in your donations and your support and everything. But just reflect on me a little bit on what this program is right now.
I can't believe it because I see it, but I mean, they have come so far, obviously with the facilities, the new field house, the upgraded offices, but I mean, UB's got good football players. I mean, now we're not talking about LSU or Alabama, but I mean, many of our players could play on some of the biggest teams in the country. So the bottom line is, since we dropped football and brought it back, we missed all those 7, 8, 9 years of just football and alumni and contributions and all that stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable because I think a lot of the other schools that were in the conference or schools we are recruiting against, they may say, oh, you don't want to go up to Buffalo. It's too cold up there. And why don't want you? So whatever our coaches have done, have got good football players, and we've won the conference, and we go to bowl games, and I think it's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. It's unbelievable. It really is. I don't know how we've done it other than hard work, obviously. And you can only play 11 guys at a time, you know. So I think however they've done the recruiting and found the guys that maybe someone else thought was a little too small or a little too slow or a little too this, and then we've developed them, and we're good. We're very good.
You know, you've always been a coach that has been one of the keys has always been taking maybe guys that your reputation is taking guys that may not always be the most talented guys and turning them into great players and a great part of a unit on an offensive line. Is being a Mid-American Conference program like UB sort of similar to that? You have to find sort of the non-polished gems sometimes?
Well, I think some of the, what do they call them, the Power Five schools or the Big Five conferences or whatever, their standards are so high. I mean, so high that there are so many good football players out there that might be an inch shorter or 15 pounds lighter or a step slower that eventually could be as good or better than the ones that are already polished. So I just think there's enough players out there that the big schools can only take so many, you know, because some year, maybe a team like LSU or Alabama or Notre Dame, you know, maybe they only need two linemen because they got a number of veterans returning. And so, I mean, I think there's enough players out there that if you work hard on the recruiting part of it and, you know, their attitude and personality, that you can get good players. I think the numbers are out there to get the players. The big schools can't take all of them, and the ones that seem to whittle down the next group, that group can be as good or almost as good as the top guys.
All right, so it's a career in football. It started in the mid-60s and continues to this day as you continue to work and run clinics and work with the Bengals. I want you to give me the things that you maybe are the most amazed about that has changed in the sport through your incredible run, and maybe the thing that you think hasn't changed the much or maybe shouldn't change the much. Just reflect for me a little bit on how this game, the sport, has changed both good and bad through your long career.
Well, I can speak more for the NFL, but it may be the same in college. In the early years, like in the NFL, many or most of the players actually lived and worked in the same community as the team they were playing for. They had to get a second job. They really associated with the fans, and in college, you know, the alumni, a lot of the kids that would go to college years and years ago got very close to the alumni. And I'm not talking about taking illegal monies. I'm just saying is nowadays, I think everybody is more in it for themselves. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't mean that they don't play hard for the team, but they're more concerned about, you know, where am I going next? And how high am I going to get drafted? If I'm a high school kid, what college is going to take me? Is my highlight film going to be on YouTube? You know, I'm in college. Can I go to the portal thing and go to another team? Or I'm not so sure that the total loyalty for that group that you're involved with is there as much as it was in the old days. You know what I mean? I don't think that's there. I mean, it's not their fault. It's probably all the social media, et cetera. I don't think the kids are any, I mean, I think the kids are just as tough nowadays. They have more protection equipment-wise. I mean, in the old days, I mean, you look at the helmets they used, or even when I first started, you know, you didn't have a lot of padding. I mean, you got hurt. I mean, you would get hurt a little bit more. And of course, now they're bigger and stronger now. I think the techniques are more refined in the offensive line. There's more refined techniques where you don't have to stick your head in and headbutt. We've developed different ways of using the body, kind of sumo type movements to defeat the defender, which is just as good as the old school fire out and stick your head in and try to kill a guy. So I think the techniques have been refined. There's more coaches. It's more technical. It's almost a little confusing because, you know, these staffs got 12, 15, 17 coaches, even the colleges. They've got computer videotape. You can find every situation from the 5-yard line going in to score on the left hash, this play, that play. It's kind of almost too much.
Okay. And the last thing I'll lead you with is for you as an offensive line coach and a former offensive line player, we talked about this. You played at 5'9", 200. Now you're standard, even college UB offensive lineman, 6'4", 300 before you're even going to think about them. Is it the size change of that position? Is it different to coach? Is it make it different coaching, or is it just the inevitable evolution of it? Because that you've seen that grow particularly so much in your career.
No, I mean, I think, well, like when you get a group together, like UB's linemen, you know, all their old linemen are big guys, real big guys. So you just, they all look the same. I mean, some are a little taller, some a little heavier, but I mean, it's like they're all kind of in the same group. So it's not like all of a sudden, you know, last year everybody was 6 foot, 220 pounds, and now this year they're all 6'5", 360. I mean, it's transitioned over time. So you as a coach have kind of got used to seeing them getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Now when you walk into a drill, you just, that's who they are. You don't make a big deal of it. You know, you may need big people to play nowadays because the other team's big and all that stuff. But no, it's just, you just, I mean, they're the same guys. They're bigger. You know, their body moves the same way. You know, they may be a little bit slow. They may be a little bit this. They may have great quickness. They may have good strength. But, you know, 30 years ago, they had the same properties, you know. Guys were strong. They were quick, whatever. It's just they're on a bigger frame now.
Right. Hey, for all of us that are involved in the program, the football program at UB and UB Athletics as a whole, we know you've played a big part, not only monetarily, but just in spirit, in helping and supporting and giving advice. And for all of us, we thank you for that. It is always fun to have you around. It's always fun to talk football with you. And hopefully by listening to this, Bulls fans have gotten a little feel for the groundwork that was laid in your great career and what it was like to be a Bull back in the days. So keep that up and keep being a part of the program. We like having you around.
Okay, Paul. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. He is Jim McNally, one of the all-time greats, former UB football player, coach, NFL assistant coach, joining us on the Forever a Bull podcast.
Once a Bull, always a Bull. This has been a production of Bulls Digital.